This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to today's Positive Parenting Show on AFN. I'm Armin Brott. Hey, how much do you know about nature? Not sure? Well, let me ask you some questions. What do you think happens to a baby bird if a human touches it? Think the parents will abandon it? If you touch a toad, will you get warts? If you cut a worm in half, will you grow two worms? Will eating carrots give you better eyesight? And is poison ivy contagious? And can animals only see in black and white? Well, you know, the answers to some of those questions might actually surprise you, which is exactly what we're going to be talking about in this part of today's show. There's a lot of facts that kids and adults learn that really aren't true at all. A lot of these things get passed on from one person to the next because there is a tiny grain of truth to them, but in a lot of cases, there's a lot more myth there than fact. It can sometimes be tricky to figure out what to believe. After all, the internet has got all sorts of information on nearly every topic imaginable, but that doesn't mean it's all true. And this is where we can help. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking about all sorts of myths about nature, and we're going to tell you what is actually true. And some of the stories are really wonderful, where they came from, how we got this myth into our system, and why it's there, and again, the actual truth behind it. So from quirky fishing and gardening advice to myths that create animal misconceptions and fears, we really think that it's time to share the truth about the outdoors. And in today's show, you're going to uncover myths about animals and plants and oceans and space, the weather, and a whole lot more. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
My name's Tyler, and in 9 years, I'll be an alcoholic. I'll start drinking in middle school, just at parties. But my parents won't start talking to me about it till high school.
Kids who drink before age 15 are 5 times more likely to have alcohol problems when they're adults.
Thing is, my parents won't even see it coming.
So start talking before they start drinking. To learn more, go to StopAlcoholAbuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Ken Keffer, who's the co-author with Stacy Tornio of The Truth About Nature, A Family's Guide to 144 Common Myths About the Great Outdoors. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
How did you decide to debunk myths about the great outdoors?
Well, you know, Stacy and I were sitting around a campfire, and we were talking about some of those things kind of in nature that come up, you know, and the one that really was our initial inspiration was that when you find a baby bird out of a nest, you know, a lot of folks think that if you pick it up and put it back in the nest, that then the parents are going to abandon that nest, and that's just not entirely true. And so we started kind of thinking about myths and some of those kind of misconceptions about the great outdoors and decided to put together a whole book of them.
Well, what exactly does happen? I mean, because you hear so much about that the parents of the bird or even other animals will smell this foreign smell on their child and they don't have anything to do with them anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, that one, the thing about it is it's not great to go and check out a bird nest, especially repeatedly, you know, and time again and stuff. And there really can be some negative consequences associated with that, you know. But the thing is that, you know, the birds aren't going to smell you on it. And really kind of the main drawback to that is the predators will often sense that you've been there and kind of follow you and find the nest. And then they can hit those babies perhaps or the eggs and things. And so while it's a good idea not to be harassing a bird's nest over and over, it's not actually that the parents are just going to abandon it, you know.
So you've got the book divided up into 4 seasons, which is kind of a nice way of doing it. And let me just ask you kind of some of the ones that just popped into my mind is, hey, I didn't know that. So I always thought one of the definitions of reptiles is that they lay eggs. And you're saying
yeah,
that they don't.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, we've got it kind of set up with a myth scale that some of these things are just completely false, you know, it's wrong information that's getting passed along. And this is one that's kind of on the other extreme where, for the most part, that's completely true, but there are a couple of exceptions to the rule. And so if you make those big, bold statements, you know, and so things like rattlesnakes actually have eggs that the female incubates inside the body, and so she's then hatching out and giving live birth of sorts. And so, you know, I mean, that's just kind of one of those misconceptions that's out there. And again, you know, I mean, so that would be like a myth scale of one on our system.
Okay, so not a complete crazy, wacky story, but something that has a little bit of truth to it.
Yeah, yeah, okay. There's definitely a lot of truth to that, you know. And so that's just kind of what we're trying to promote, too, is that, yeah. You know, you just kind of really dig a little deeper and just not take everything as a blanket statement like that and kind of learn kind of the exceptions to the rule as important as learning the rule.
Well, what about bees dying after they sting you? Now, some of them do, don't they? I mean,
yeah.
Isn't it like they pull
true.
Out
some
the stinger
do.
That's kind of pulling out their guts, right?
Exactly, yeah. It hurts you and them. And so, yeah, that's something that we've, you know, kind of all learned as well. But then there's a lot of species that can sting repeatedly, and there's some species that don't even really like to sting at all. You know, I mean, that's kind of their last resort thing. And so, yeah, again, that's another one of those that's you know, a miss scale of one. So it's, you know, mostly true, but there are some exceptions out there.
Okay, here's one that I'm sure that people are going to rush right out as soon as they hear this, as long as it's raining. So rainbows, you're saying, don't have seven colors.
Right, yeah. I mean, a lot of times you're going to see all seven, but how many times have you been out there after the rain and, you know, you're looking for that Roy G. Biv and maybe not all of the colors are quite visible, you know, I mean, just the way that light's reflecting through those rain droplets and stuff, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it's not always going to be just a classic scene that we see painted or in our imagination and stuff.
Okay. All right. So for those of us who grew up watching Popeye, the whole notion that spinach is not going to make you stronger, it seems to be just destroying a childhood fantasy.
I don't mean to crush you. I mean, Popeye is on to something, and spinach is definitely a good, very nutritious, leafy green, you know, and whether it's spinach or kale or any of those, you
yeah.
know, you need to eat your leafy green so you can be strong. But the thing about Popeye, remember, he cracked open that can, he gulped it down, and was instantly a superhuman strength and stuff. And so that's just not quite, you know, quite the truth when it comes to that spinach. You gotta have a nice, well-balanced diet that includes some spinach, but it's not a magic pill. You can't just pop that spinach and have superhuman strength.
Now, kind of back to one of these ones that has some element of truth to it. If you cut a worm in half, you grow two worms.
Right.
There's
yeah.
some
I mean,
some species
people, especially,
do,
I mean,
right?
These kids that we're talking to on a lot of these things, you know, they think, oh, a worm looks the same on both ends. How do you even know where the head is? And if you cut it in half, they think you have two worms, and they're going to both survive and live to grow into two separate worms. And there's, you know, pretty technical stuff on some of this. Depends on which part of the worm you're cutting off. The tail end pretty much is going to die off, you know, no matter what. And sometimes that head end, if you don't cut too much of it off, might survive a little bit, you know. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of kind of gray, fuzzy area in between there. But you're definitely not going to end up with two separate worms that can crawl around. And worms, you know, they can wiggle quite a bit after until mm-hmm. they finally, you know, actually end up dying off. And so it might think that you have two worms for quite a while there.
Now, what about lizards? There's this kind of conception I think a lot of people have that if you cut off a lizard's tail, that it grows back. Now, that happens to some extent, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. There's some species, you know, and it depends on the species. And so some of them, you know, I mean, they can lose their tail. And that's a very handy defense mechanism. If you're a lizard and some hawk swoops down to eat you and it hits that tail, it's a lot better to be a tailless lizard than it is to be a dead lizard. And so that is a very cool adaptation. And some species can kind of regenerate that tail a little bit, and others will just kind of have a little stubby tail that's not going to grow back, but they're going to survive without a tail and stuff. And so, yeah, it really pays, you know, to dig a little deeper on all of these sorts of nature myths and figure out, like, the whole truth of what's going on.
Now, you didn't talk about this specifically, but there was one that kind of got me thinking about it. You had tornadoes turn clockwise, and I was thinking about, okay, you got the water going down the drain in the northern hemisphere, supposedly goes one way and supposedly goes the other way in the southern hemisphere. Do you know about that one? Is that true?
That is, you know, I actually traveled to South Africa with my parents, and that was one of the things I was most looking forward to. I wanted to see the southern night sky, and I also wanted to see how the toilets, you know, if they swirled counterclockwise, and I was very disappointed to learn that the toilets that I flushed in South Africa, they just like slushed like straight down. There was no swirl either direction, so I wasn't able to verify firsthand how they swirl around, you know. But yeah, I have done a little looking into that, and they can swirl either direction down there too. So
the water going down the drain, you could spin it with your finger and get it going one way.
Right.
Okay. All right. So what was the most surprising one in spring that you found?
Yeah, I mean, the book, we set it up by season. And,
right.
You know, it's kind of a nice way to think about lots of the things that you're doing in nature. And so, I mean, a lot of times for spring, you're thinking new life. You're thinking babies and stuff. And the one that, you know, I think we really run into, and in my background, I've worked a lot with birds over the years. And so the kids, they will come to, like, you know, the nature center, and they'll be like, oh, listen to the pretty birds singing. They're so happy about spring, you know. And, like, being from, you know, Wisconsin, we get some brutal winters. And so those spring songs are really happy thoughts, and they kind of, you know, are a new season for us. And so a lot of folks think that birds are singing because they're happy. And, you know, really what's going on in a lot of instances is that the males are kind of are calling out to either attract the females or to talk to the other males and say, hey, this is my territory over here. So birds sing for different reasons, and it's, you know, it's us that it makes happy. It's not that the birds are singing because they're so happy.
So if you lay a rope around your campsite, that's not going to keep snakes out, huh?
That's one. I grew up in Wyoming, and so, you know, that's one of those old cowboy legends, and I remember my uncles talking about sleeping out under the stars, and this is one Stacy had never even heard of. She's like, what? That's a myth, you know? I was like, yeah, people think that, and so there's a couple of different theories behind that, and so the way the myth goes is that, yeah, if you're sleeping outside and you lay a rope around your campsite or maybe just around your sleeping bag, that the snakes aren't going to crawl over that. And so it's either that, you know, they think it's another snake maybe, or they don't want to crawl up and over that because it'll scratch their bellies perhaps, you know. But if you think about snakes in nature and stuff, I mean, they're crawling
piled
over
up on top of each other, yeah.
Of things.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't really faze them at all. And the other part of it is, you know, I mean, what's a snake want to crawl into your stinky sleeping bag for anyway? Some people think it's for the warmth and stuff, but I think it's just one of those things that just gets passed on from generation to generation, and it's just not true.
But they do want to crawl into your sleeping bag, probably.
So they can cuddle up to me and be all warm and stuff. No, snakes, they don't really want to have much to do with us.
That's awfully disappointing, if we want to consider ourselves to be top of the food chain. All right. I'm talking with Ken Keffer, who's the co-author with Stacy Tornio of The Truth About Nature, A Family's Guide to 144 Common Myths About the Great Outdoors. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to move into some of the other seasons and talk with Ken some more about some more myths. I'm Armin Brott. You're listening to Positive Parenting. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Ken Keffer, who's the co-author of The Truth About Nature, A Family's Guide to 144 Common Myths About the Great Outdoors. All right, so let's go to summer. Birds have no sense of smell. I can't imagine that anybody would think that. It seems like that they're driven by smell like most animals, that they can smell stuff from miles away.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of times for kids, they really try and relate to animals and project those same sorts of feelings and emotions and senses that, you know, we experience onto birds. And there are a couple of exceptions to the rule, but for the most part, smell is not a sense that's very well developed in birds. And so, yeah, the birds aren't out there smelling for the food necessarily or anything. But what's really cool about that is the exceptions to the rule, and that's things like turkey vultures. And so if you're a bird that lives on decaying carcasses, you'd use that sense of smell to find your next meal. And so, yeah, there are some birds that do have a well-developed sense of smell, but for the most part, smell isn't something that birds necessarily experience.
How about a turtle being on its back?
The this
that
one.
They can't
we
flip
still,
over.
You know, we hear from kids, they're like, oh, that's true, I've heard that, you know, that if a turtle is on its back, it's helpless. And turtle shells are something we have a hard time relating to, you know. It's not like anything we've experienced necessarily. And if we're on our back, I mean, that's one of our earliest childhood achievements, right? I mean, it's watching us roll over. That's one of the things that we all strive for, you know, if you're watching your own children.
Yeah.
And for turtles, yeah. I mean, they're crawling up and they maybe get toppled over. I mean, I don't even know how a turtle gets on its back to begin with, but once it's over there, it takes some effort, but they can actually thrust around and get flipped back over on their bellies too, so... Yeah.
I guess I'd like to see that. I mean, you know, they're so wide and the legs are so short, you wouldn't think they'd be able to actually throw their weight enough in one direction. But I guess they
can. Yeah, they're kind of kicking that one side of their legs around a little bit, and they got to be able to right themselves back up.
I guess they're not in any big hurry since they're turtles
sure,
anyway.
It's not a race.
Yeah. All right, so what about poison ivy being contagious? I could have sworn that we don't have poison ivy out here in California, but we do have poison oak.
Yeah, the poison oak on your head.
And that's, so, yeah. I don't know, I always heard that was contagious, is not?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when we think contagious, it's kind of like, you know, we think of like a sickness, you know, and so like if you're in the same room as somebody else and they've got the flu, that's pretty contagious. You can pick that up, you know, with the germs and stuff, get passed from person to person. And with poison ivy, I mean, it's so some people are so sensitive to poison ivy. It would seem like if they were in the same time zone as poison ivy, they would have a reaction and they would be all itching and stuff. But no, the way the oils work, you really got to get in there and get some actual contact directly with the poison ivy, and that's where the rash develops. What's really cool about poison ivy is it can change for a person too, you know, and so I'm one of those very lucky people that can basically be standing in a patch of poison ivy and not have much of a reaction. But, you know, some other people can just barely brush against it, and they have that same, you know, a bad response and reaction, kind of an allergy to it. And so it can seem like it's contagious, but you really have to have that contact.
Now, what about this whole thing about not swimming after for 30 minutes?
That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, that one just refuses to die hard, or it dies hard, I know.
Yeah. I mean, some parents, some kids, you know, they say like the rule is it's got to be 30 minutes after your meal or 45 or maybe an hour. But everybody knows you can't just have a big meal and then go for a swim, right? I mean, you're going to get a bellyache, you're going to cramp up, you might drown. Who knows what's going to happen, but it's definitely not going to be good, right? Yeah,
well,
but the thing is that, you know, it's just not really true. So that's one that I personally never really learned how to swim that good. So I never really had a concern with it. But
well, that was because you were eating too much.
That's
you never
true.
Had a chance.
I would much
yeah.
rather eat and eat and eat rather than go for a swim.
Well, I think there's some logic there. I mean, I think anybody who exercises would understand or would probably go along with the idea that if you eat a big meal and then go work out, you're going to have some problems. I mean, you're
right.
Not going to die necessarily, but you're not going to feel very good.
Yeah, it's probably not the most ideal time to go for a big, you know, exercise, you know. But if you're a kid and you're at the beach and, you know, it's hard enough to pull yourself away from the ocean to have lunch and then much less to sit around for 30 minutes afterwards, no,
yeah.
You're going to jump right back in that water.
And you know, there was one I want to just jump back to spring for a sec because I forgot about this one. But, I mean, there are some that there are sort of entertaining myths and, I didn't know that kind of things. But then there are some that are kind of dangerous, that placing butter on a burn to soothe the pain actually can make it worse.
Yeah, and that's the thing is some of these sort of, you know, home remedies and stuff are really bad, and that's one of those examples that, yeah, that's the worst thing you want to do, right? But yet it still gets passed around from generation to generation as a cure, and it's really just, it's very unsafe.
Where did it come from?
I don't know the origins on that, you know. I mean, a lot of these, and some of them have a little more regional effect, and so I think some people, like, you know, in some places that's one that gets, you know, passed down more frequently in some parts of the country, perhaps.
Yeah. Do you think that's related in any way to putting a steak on a black eye kind of thing? Or is that, I always thought that was just the cold.
Yeah.
That does it.
You know, there's some of those examples where that it might actually have some sort of effect. And really, is it like the temperature? Is it the coldness? Is it the warmth? Yeah. I mean, there's different reasons for it and stuff. And so, yeah, the butter on the burn, though, that's one that just is really perplexing.
And I guess right up there, and this is probably one that very few people are doing, but heard about it before, if a jellyfish stings, you have to have someone pee on the injured spot.
Right. Yeah, that one. I mean, that's
where did that
a couple
come
of
from?
Like popular, you know, there's been movies and TV shows and stuff that have talked about that one. And yeah, there's a little bit of debate on what's going on, but it might be the warmth that's actually helping on that and stuff. But it's, again, not the most sanitary practice and not the best idea to be peeing on your jellyfish things. I mean, the best idea is to avoid the jellyfish to begin with, right?
That would be the smart thing to do, and I don't think I'd want anybody to pee on me anyway.
Right, yeah. My favorite is some people swear that it's got to be your pee or maybe somebody else that pees on you. I mean, that's a really good friend that's going to pee on you for, you know, to save you from a jellyfish sting, right?
Well, that doesn't take a whole lot out of the friend, I guess. It's really the person who's going to want somebody to pee on you. But so this thing about cows having four stomachs, I mean, that is like taught in every second grade class. How is that wrong?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the four chambers of the same stomach, right? I have a little confession to make. I got that question wrong on my college test. And it's like you had to list the four parts of a ruminant stomach. And I just had that test anxiety where I forgot the rumen. I got all the other ones, but I forgot the obvious one.
What are the other ones?
Oh, you're going to quiz me on the spot.
Well,
so
absolutely.
Let me see. There's, I don't remember them all right off. Cecum, is that a part?
I don't know. All right, yeah, we can skip that. I'm not going to put you on the spot too terribly much.
There's four parts, though. One stomach, four chambers.
Yeah. All right, so we have this whole holiday built on groundhogs being able to predict the weather. Where did that come from? Is that just
Where did that come from?
Nuts.
Yeah, that one is just is pretty silly if we think about it. How are they going to be able to predict the weather? That seems like really good marketing on somebody's part, right?
You'd think, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, those poor, and can you imagine the first groundhog that gets awoke from his little winter slumber and is like, hey, wake up and tell us the weather, you know? Yeah, I think it's that if you get, you know, a bright sunny day and he sees a shadow or versus not, yeah, it's one of those silly things that we all enjoy kind of the symbolism of it. But, yeah, I think weather is hard enough to predict for all the meteorologists out there and to rely on the groundhog to tell us. There's also things like the caterpillars, right? I don't know if maybe out there for you guys, but here in Wisconsin and Wyoming where I grew up, you know, the woolly bear caterpillars, it depends on how big the stripes are, how hard the winter's going to be. And a lot of these things, you know, I mean, it's just that kind of correlation, and it doesn't actually make it true necessarily.
No, but it makes it fun to speculate
about
it, I guess.
It is a fun speculation.
Yeah. Now, what about woodpeckers? And we give them that name, so I suppose, you know, that definitely makes it so, I suppose, right?
That's right. Woodpeckers peck wood, right? Obviously. Yeah. Except for what if you are one of those woodpeckers that lives in, I don't know, like southern Arizona, like maybe you're a Gila woodpecker, and you're surrounded by a forest of saguaro cactus. And there's not much wood to actually peck here, then you're a cactus pecker. We should call them the Gila cactus pecker instead or something.
Well, you know, it would only be fair if they would just rename themselves.
That naming so birds is a very tricky proposition. Yeah. I mean, there's things like the red-bellied woodpecker. This is one that's, you know, it looks kind of like a flicker, and it's got a lot of red on the head. And so that's a question. I don't think it actually made the book as a full myth, but it's a question that comes up. People are like, why don't they call it the red-headed woodpecker? And, well, it's because there already is a red-headed woodpecker, and that one is on the cover of the book, you know? And if you can't see the belly of the red-bellied woodpecker, you wouldn't know that there's just a little faint splash of red on that little belly. So it's still a good name for the woodpecker. But it's just not the most obvious thing that we would think of sometimes.
So I want to run two more by you, and that'll be the end of it. So porcupines throw their quills and ostriches burying their heads in the sand.
Right. Yeah. So the porcupines, I mean, this one's kind of like the poison ivy where it just seems like, I mean, if you've ever encountered a porcupine, you give it plenty of space, and especially for pets often. I mean, it's usually a dog that finds a porcupine maybe, and they get a little too close. And it would seem like that quill just, like, get thrown off the porcupine and, you know, maybe a couple of feet away. But really, that dog's in there a little too close or, you know, you could brush against the porcupine. And they're really loose, so it doesn't take much contact. And they've got, like, little fish hook, little barbels on the end that really can help penetrate and hook into that skin. And so, Yeah, it really, you know, it seems like they're throwing their quills out there, and they're not quite, but, you know, you still got to give porcupines plenty of space. And as far as the ostriches burying their hand, you know, I mean, this is one where if you can see, you know, if you're like at an ostrich farm, or maybe you've traveled to Africa and seen, you know, ostriches on the savanna and stuff, and they spend a lot of time with their head down, and they're grazing along the grasses and picking up insects and stuff, and kind of, you know, they got their head down, but that they're burying their hand under the ground, and then really to take it to that next level where they're trying to, like, you know, they're trying to hide. It's a silly concept, and it's really just not true.
All right. Ken Keffer, thank you very much for disabusing us of all those myths. He's the author.
Sorry, I've crushed your dreams on some of those.
It's terrible.
That's really what we're all about, is exploring the truth about nature and trying to figure out, you know, fact from fiction.
Yep, and the book is called The Truth About Nature, A Family's Guide to 144 Common Myths About the Great Outdoors. Ken, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
All right, bye. Hey there, welcome back to today's show. I'm Armin Brott. Every year, Sam Fuse and I go to New York for Toy Fair, which is a completely crazy experience, and we'll be bringing you a lot of reviews from there directly. But we always try to make some predictions about what's going to happen this coming year as opposed to what happened last year. And so in 2014, robots and game figures were incredibly hot, and we're predicting that they're going to be even hotter this year. I want to give you a few of our favorites as we move into the new year. Let's start with Tipster from WowWE. You probably remember Meep, the terrific robot that we reviewed a couple of months ago. Well, Tipster is kind of like Meep's little brother. He can balance on two wheels like Big Bro, but, you know, he's young, so he prefers to balance on four instead. Tipster has got five different play modes. With Tippy Tunes, he starts playing a tune, and your child tries to pile as much stuff on him as possible before the music stops. And then, when the music stops, Tipster starts spinning, and everything flies around all over the place. With Dizzy Builder, it's kind of switched a little bit. Tipster starts spinning first, and the child is trying to attach all sorts of objects to him as the spinning is going on. The other three modes are similar in that they feature different variations on stacking and knocking over, which is exactly what little kids and lots of us parents really, really enjoy. Now, the buttons on Tipster himself and on the remote are big and colorful, and they make this robot really easy to operate right out of the box. It's for ages 4 and up, costs about $50 at your favorite retailer or at wowwee.com, W-O-W-W-E-E. Then there's Ozobots. It's O-Z-O-B-O-T. Now, these little guys are aimed at a much more sophisticated audience than Tipster. They look pretty simple. They kind of like miniature R2-D2s, and their talent is in following lines. And you can either draw the lines yourself, or you can download all sorts of patterns from the website. Ozobots change their color to match the color of the line that they're following. But the real fun starts when you use the Ozo codes, which are combinations of colored dots that tell your Ozobot how to move. For example, if you draw red and green and blue right next to each other, that slows the bot down to a snail's pace. If you draw blue and green and blue right next to each other, that gives the bot a turbo boost and he goes flying off all over the place. You can change the direction he's moving and make him dance and make him go backwards and forwards. It's really a lot of fun. But our absolute favorite was what they call the brain teasers, which are like mazes, but there are various pieces missing, little sections missing. And in order to get your bot through the maze, you're going to have to find the right color in the right codes and color it in so that the bot will be able to make it all the way through. Ozobots come two in a pack, which is really great, and that makes them absolutely perfect for parent-child competition or for parent-child cooperation. We kind of think they're good for ages 8 and up. Cost about $60 at Amazon or at ozobot.com, O-Z-O-B-O-T.com. Now, this next one is not exactly a robot. It's kind of programming a robot, and it's called Robot Turtles, and it's by Think Fun. It's for preschoolers, and can you imagine coding for preschoolers? Well, absolutely, absolutely. The object is to move your turtle from one of the corner spaces of an 8x8 matrix to a matching colored jewel that's in the middle of the board. You got cards that give directions on how to move the turtle. So you go one space forward, you turn left, you go one more space forward, you turn right, that kind of thing. Now, the kids are the programmers. They're picking the cards and putting them out in order so that they'll be able to get their turtle from the right place. But you are the computer. And so the programmers are bossing you around by giving you cards, just like real programmers do with real computers. Now, the first round is pretty easy. But once the kids have mastered it, you, the adult again, can add all sorts of obstacles that the players have to figure out ways to navigate around. It's really good for 2 to 4 preschoolers, plus there has to be one adult who can do the actual moving of the pieces. Each round gets more and more complex and more fun. These things cost about $40.50 for the whole game, and that's at Amazon or at thinkfun.com. We also had a chance to take a look at some non-robot things altogether. They were just figures. Great way to interact with your Nintendo characters is the new Amiibo. And you just touch them to your Wii U gamepad controller, and they jump right into your favorite games. You don't need an upgrade. You don't need a portal. It's terrific. It cuts the cost by a lot and makes these things a lot more accessible to everyone. All you got to do is buy the ones that you want, and you customize them in the game and interact the way that you want to interact. There's about 39 of these Amiibo figures, and it's A-M-I-I-B-O, by the way, and they're available now, about those 39, but there are a lot more, of course, on the horizon. They're about $15 a piece. That's not a bad price, and they're for ages 5 and up, and you can get them at Nintendo.com or your favorite retailer. Now, our last item for today is the Epic Optimus Prime from Hasbro, and Epic Optimus is he's a huge, huge figure. He's 22 inches tall. It's a little bit less than 2 feet. He's a transformer who doesn't actually transform, but you got to take it from us. Your child will not care at all. I know that sounds a little bit counterintuitive, but it's absolutely true. The Epic Optimus Prime's size and the fact that his chest opens up and reveals a command center that you can put all sorts of other minifigures in, you have to buy them separately, that will more than make up for the lack of transformer capabilities. They're about aimed for about ages 5 and up and run about $25. You can find more information on these products and a lot of other games and toys that we've reviewed at parentsatplay.com. All one word, parentsatplay.com. We'll be back next week with another Parents at Play column. Don't go yet, though. We've got a lot more positive parenting straight ahead for you. I'm Armin Brott. Hello and welcome to the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show on the American Forces Network. I'm Armin Brott. Thanks for staying with us. You know, science is the ultimate parenting tool, if you really think about it. After all, it's all about observing and asking questions and solving problems and making mistakes and trying again and then trying again and again after that. It's just like being a mom or a dad, right? Well, I'm going to invite you along on a little bit of an adventure with a woman named Lynn Brunell as she going to talk to us about her style of geek parenting. She's a proud geek mom herself, and she's also an Emmy Award-winning writer for the show Bill Nye the Science Guy, which most of us have probably seen. She's had a love of science from the time she was a kid. When she had her own kids, science became like a friend that she could lean on for support, helping her make sense of the joy and the pain and the uncertainty of parenting. Lynn is incredibly knowledgeable, and she's also incredibly funny, and she's going to be taking us on a tour through her book where she's got directions and explanations of some of the smelliest and most awkward things you could possibly deal with and how to turn them into teaching moments. As she puts it, the more you ask, the more you know. The more you know, the more you wonder. And the more you wonder, the more beautiful the ride. And science, by the way, is not just for geeks. It's the future. And if you're a parent or you're planning to become one, it's your future and your kids' future, too. We're going to talk about science and curiosity and wide-eyed wonderment when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
Excuse me, do you know how to get to Maine and Maple?
How's that cook?
How do you change the ringtone?
How much does this cost?
Does this bus stop at Elm Street?
We ask questions everywhere in life, except...
Any questions?
No.
At the doctor's office, ask questions.
What is this test for?
Are there any side effects?
Questions lead to better health care. Go to ahrq.gov for a list of 10 questions everyone should know. Questions are the answer. Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Lynn Brunell, who's the author of Mama Gone Geek, calling on my inner science nerd to help navigate the ups and downs of parenthood. Lynn, thanks for joining us. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. I mean, you probably have seen, and I'm sure a lot of us have seen a lot of your work. You were a writer for Bill Nye the Science Guy.
I was. It's been a long-standing passion of mine to make things accessible and funny.
And how did you start with that? Do you have? Are you a scientist by background?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I talk about my background, I can make it sound like, isn't it great the way I planned my life? But it's, but going forward, it wasn't like that. Going forward, I just pursued my passions. I majored in biology, English, and art history when I was in college. And
it sounds like the resume of somebody with ADD.
I think it is. In fact, I think I discovered that when my son, when we discovered my son had ADD, and we were doing the tests, and I thought, wow, I think this is me. I've just always thought of it as multitask.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I majored in a bunch of different things, and I found myself in the classroom teaching, and that was really awesome, and I really wanted to reach out again, making things accessible, sort of complicated things accessible in a fun way. Because when I was growing up, I had, you know, okay teachers, and then I had that odd, amazing teacher who just made things sparkle where they didn't sparkle before. And I thought that would be a really great way to spend my life. And so that's kind of the thread that's been going through most of the things from the classroom. Then I went into publishing, and then I saw Bill Nye on TV, and I thought, I think that needs to be my next job. And it was. I got a chance to kind of combine my dream combination of laughter and science, and putting it together on TV.
Is it still on? My kids are past that age, so I don't watch it as much as I.
It may be on in pockets. We did 100 episodes, and then it was over for us. It was a Disney property, and that to them is a syndicatable chunk. So I'm pretty sure people are still using it in classrooms, but it's not on air, I don't think, anymore.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't too terribly out of date with everything.
No, not at all.
All right, so let's talk about you and your inner geek and your inner science nerd. How did you decide to go and start writing a book about it? I mean, so you know, writing for Bill Nye, certainly you have obviously some command of science, but, you know, there's a lot of science stuff out there.
There is a lot of science stuff out there.
Not from your perspective.
I have found that when I was teaching, my first classroom teaching experience way back, I'm dating myself here, is back in the day when they would take behavior problem kids, and I say that in quotation marks, anyone who wasn't learning in the norm, they would take them out of the mainstream classroom and put them into another classroom. So, and that was my classroom. So I had grades 4 through 8, all the kids that wouldn't fit into the mainstream classroom. And it was eye-opening. It was eye-opening. Aside from a couple of kids who were just plain scary, most of the kids were really, really amazingly bright. They just learned in a different way. And I learned from them so much about how to teach kids. You know, there's more than one way to get the information in. And honestly, if you make it fun and funny and make it accessible in a way that's going to work for them, then they're going to carry it around and be able to use it in the rest of their lives. And so that's been the kind of that's been the core of my geekiness. I mean, I think I've been a geek for as long as I can remember. In my book, I talk about winning the most persistent camper award when I was passionate about horses and would talk about horses to anybody at summer camp who didn't move away rapidly. And that's when I really discovered that I was a nerd. But I use that. I use it in getting cool information across, getting these things that are accessible. And it's especially important now because we really are having an issue with science literacy in this country, and it's something that we really want to pass on. We should want to pass on to our kids the joy of learning about science so in the future we can have some creative problem solvers that can help us with some of the problems that we're kind of creating for ourselves.
You know, one of the things I like about this book, and it kind of fits generally into the category that I cannot remember now the author who's written 50 Dangerous Things to Do with Your Kids, and just, I mean, the idea of making science fun instead of having it be boring, and, you know, how you can learn about gravity and friction by throwing an orange out of the window of a moving car, as long as you don't throw it at somebody, you know, so you can see what happens when something hits the ground at a speed. And you're talking about one of the first things in the book is a Leaf Smash T-shirt where you're going to absolutely destroy a T-shirt.
Oh, no, you're not. It's the coolest thing in the world. So, We were playing with chlorophyll. We were talking about grass stains, and I thought, oh, you know, In ancient times, that's what you made art out of, was what you had around you, right? So people, I'm sure, used the green of grass or the green of leaves in order to color something, right? So I had told the kids, okay, get a hammer, let's smash these things. You know, here's a paper towel, let's smash it. Don't smash your fingers, that'll make a different color on the T-shirt. And I really thought we were going to get these little sort of green explosions. And I thought, okay, well, we'll call it chlorophyll fireworks, you know, blah, blah, blah. But we took a fern, we laid it on a T-shirt, put a paper towel on top of that, hammered away, which was the kid's favorite part. And then when we lifted up that paper towel, we had this perfect image of a fern. It was incredible. So what you did is you're breaking the cells open and the chlorophyll is leaking out, but you're getting what looks like a photographic print. It is the most incredible thing in the world. Now, if you take the hammer or a sledgehammer and you hit it really hard, you can trash the T-shirt, but that's not the point.
Well, what I meant, I didn't mean trash the T-shirt because you're going to be creating a work of art, but it's the kind of thing that I think most people, when they see grass stains or green stains on something, think, that's the end of that one.
Yeah, no, it's true, and I think a lot of, at least a lot of my journey in teaching science is there kind of are no mistakes, there are no wrong answers, and you do a lot of making lemonade out of lemons. You know, it's like turn it and just change the lens. I mean, that's, I think, what this is about, is just taking the lens and saying, what can we wonder about? What can we play with? What can we dabble in? And what can we learn? You know, because I think the more that you wonder, the more you learn, the more you learn, the more you wonder. And then everything becomes this sort of miraculously magnificent thing, even if it's mundane.
Yeah, there was, I just read Feynman's book, Richard Feynman, who, you know, he's been dead for quite a few years, but he was a Nobel Prize winner. And I don't remember poetry, but he had a poem of his which was exactly kind of what you're talking about. He says, I wonder why I wonder. I wonder why I wonder why.
Which was kind of. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, it was thought, wow, you have to read that a few times to figure out what he's saying. But it's interesting. You wonder, and then you wonder why, and then you ask another question, and it just keeps on going.
Yeah, so and it back, starts to sparkle. Everything does.
Back to the green T-shirt for just a sec.
Yes.
So is there something that you can do to lock in the green?
Yes. So once you hammer it in, right, and this is kind of a cool experiment to do, too. We learned it through making mistakes. If the sun hits it before you do anything, it'll actually oxidize the chlorophyll and turn it brown. But if you take that T-shirt after you've made the print, and it can be any leaf. It's got to be kind of a juicy leaf, but not too juicy. You break it open, you get it, and you throw it in the dryer, or if you iron it, you'll set the stain, and it's like setting a grass stain, because that's all it is. It's a glorified grass stain. It just happens to be that you're putting the pressure from above, so you're making a print of whatever it is below.
Yeah, exactly.
And you toss it in the dryer, and you'll fix it. And I mean, if you wash it with bleach over and over again, it'll go away, but pretty much you can keep it. And it's awesome. I mean, my kids, we've done pillowcases with leaves on it so that they can sleep in the woods in the wintertime.
Oh, that's a great thing. So just a very quick one. I just was reading, I read the whole book, but of course looking through this and trying to find things to talk to you about. Homemade washable body paint. I had one of my fondest childhood memories was when my dad got me and my two sisters, we were very young, out, stripped us down to our underwear, and we painted each other. It was just like the most fun thing ever.
It is the fun thing. So that chapter came about as a result of my kids were very, very young. My oldest was, I want to say he was 4. And he and his best friend, Lulu, they just did everything together. And it was all very fun and innocent until the time that they decided that they were going to take all their clothes off. And that was fun, too. So it got to the point where we finally had to say, you know, okay, rules when we play. We're going to keep our clothes on, right? We're going to include everyone because we're not going to exclude our younger brother. We're not going to do any of that. We're going to keep our clothes on and exclude everyone. So that became our mantra. And we went over to dinners at Lulu's family's house. And in the car, I you know, brushed up with Kai on the rules. What are the rules? And he's like, I know. Include everyone and keep our clothes on. So we thought everything was fine, except for I saw Lulu with an impish look, and she had taken her mom's bag. And they were really quiet. You know, it's always dangerous when the kids are quiet. And so I went in, and my youngest, who was 2.5, was buck naked, covered in lipstick. Kai and Lulu were fine. They were in their clothes, and I was like, whoa, what's going on here? And they're like, what? We included everyone, and we kept our clothes on.
Excellent.
But poor Leo was covered with lipstick, and so we thought, okay, well, we're going to kind of how are we going to make this something fun? So we did, and yeah, washable. Washable is the key word there. Washable body paint.
Talking with Lynn Brunell, who's the author of Mama Gone Geek, calling on my inner science nerd to help navigate the ups and downs of parenthood. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Lynn and get into some more of her wild science experiments. I'm Armin Brandt. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brandt. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Lynn Brunell, who's the author of Mama Gone Geek, calling my inner science nerd to help navigate the ups and downs of parenthood. So, playing with fire. How about that one?
Well, here's the thing. I have two boys, and they are fascinated with fire. Fireworks, firecrackers, candles, all this stuff, right? And so you kind of try to run interference and say no. But when we were camping, they were just drawn to the campfire, and I thought, you know what, I could say no and make it this scary thing that they're not supposed to touch, or we can say, look, you need to respect it and go ahead, play with it. This is what we're going to do. I'm going to teach you how to play with it well. I mean, that was a kind of an exercise for mommy to let go too, and say, if you give the kids the right knowledge and the right respect and the right understanding, they're going to be able to treat it well, and it's a lot better than having it be something that is off limits. So that's what we did for that camping for us and two boys was all about the campfire and what we can make melt and what we can make burn and all that kind of stuff. So they were very excited that they could make fire and make fire out of the sun and make the right the fire in the fireplace and do all the right things. And then when they asked me what fire was, I was faced with something I didn't really know the answer to. I mean, I knew it was a reaction, and I knew it was oxidation, I knew it was a bunch of things, but I couldn't really explain it. So it was a great opportunity to say to them, I don't know, let's look it up. And we did that together too, and so it was fun. It was a good exploration.
How do you draw the line between fun and safety? Because safety's got to be in there. I mean, you're going to be playing with pretty much anything you could be hurt with, but right. With fire certainly, or with electricity.
Well, I think that's what you do. Is that the first thing you say? Is this is a big deal. This is a dangerous thing, and I'm going to teach you the right way to look at this stuff and to experiment with this stuff and even play with this stuff. There's a right way and a wrong way, and you got to make that really, really clear. And I think if you teach the proper respect for it, and talk about that, then they come armed. Kids don't want to wreck things. But if they're armed, and and there's a certain age, you're not going to give a 2-year-old a match. But when they're old enough to know better, then they become responsible citizens. They've got the information, and they can be responsible about it. I think you have fewer accidents.
Besides fire and wanting to destroy things, kids also like gross stuff, and they like to make noises. And it's just not actually my youngest one's about 11.
Oh, yeah.
And within the last couple months, we were just fooling around. We had some balloons, and I was blowing up a balloon with my nose, which she found wonderfully entertaining. And then I was looking through your book and saw nose flute and armpit fart, which I think is, people are just screaming, oh, my God, how could you possibly? But tell us about those.
Well, we had we had the first parent-teacher conference with our kindergarten teacher. And so Keith and I were very excited. We thought we were going to go in there and be regaled with how amazing Kai was, because he is. And we sat down, and the teacher said, Kai's doing fine. Oh, it was Leo, actually. I'm sorry. It was Leo's doing fine. But I have to tell you, Keith, he's been making rude sounds with his armpits, and he's been teaching all the other kids how to do it, and he's telling them that it's science. And so Keith totally tosses me under the bus, and he goes, well, that's not me, that's her. And I try to laugh, and I'm like, oh, well, And then I started thinking, well, it is kind of science, because we had been talking about what sound is and what vibrations are. And then it made me wonder as a person, what's the difference between noise and music? And so we played, the kids and I played, and it kind of came to the point where, you know what, armpit farts could be music, right? Because it's this cool vibration. You're trapping air in a pocket, and then you're squeezing that air past two surfaces, and those two surfaces are vibrating, and then that vibrates the air, which reaches our ears. And so we did the whole thing. We traced it into ears. We did it, all that stuff. And then and then one morning, as I was pondering this whole thing, I saw that my camera, my little flip camera, had been taken, and the boys had made a movie, and I watched it. they were playing "Ode to Joy." Ty had stuck the recorder up his nose and was playing, you know, toot 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 with his nose, and Leo comes running in, and he accompanies him on the armpit fart, and it was the best rendition of "Ode to Joy" I've ever heard. So it made me realize, you know what? It's okay to be the rebellious, not really rebellious to be a stinker, but to be rebellious and say, you know what? Maybe armpit farts are music, and it certainly is science.
All right, so here's another thing that's going to push the boundaries a little bit. I mean, I think everybody's got a kid, or we all did it this when we were growing up ourselves. You find some animal out there someplace, and I remember bringing home a mouse at one point. I trapped in a park. Oh, can I keep it? Can I keep it as a pet? So everybody wants to do that, but very rarely do you hear of anybody who wants to make a pet out of lice. You think, which you've got a chapter on. I thought, wow. I remember we had a lice episode in my house, as so many of us do, and capturing one of them and looking at him under the microscope was just fascinating, but I never thought, well, we'll just keep him and breed them. I mean,
it's true. You know, that's another ultimate making lemonade out of lemons there. Yeah. What we encountered in our community was, I mean, lice wasn't even on my radar, and everyone was weirdly secretive about it, you know, and you'd have people come up and whisper, I heard that in Leo's class somebody has lice. You didn't hear it from me, right? And then just as this mom was telling me this, I'm watching Leo go away on the school bus, and he starts scratching his head as if on cue. And, of course, as soon as she said it to me, my head started itching, but I wasn't going to scratch in front of her. And then I realized we actually did have this lice, and I was mortified the whole nine yards, and everyone kept saying, oh, there's no shame in it. But if there was no shame in it, why weren't people talking about it? You know, why weren't people just saying, hey, this is an issue and this is what's going on? So we went to the doctor. We had an appointment, and I said to the doctor, you know, someone in Leo's class might have lice. And he went, ew. And I'm like, oh, my God, you winced. So he looked. He lifted up Leo's hair with the end of a pencil and shone a flashlight on, and he kind of gasped. And there they were. They were jumping all over Leo's head. And again, I was mortified, and Kai, who was older, he was mortified, but Leo was psyched. He's like naming him. He's like, yay! So I took it as an opportunity to talk to them about, you know, we live on this planet. We don't live alone. You know, there's all sorts of creatures that are doing the same thing we're doing. You know, we're trying to make a living. We have kids. We're trying to do our best we can. Well, that's what lice are doing. They just are doing it on our heads, which is kind of gross, right? So, as I said, Leo was the one that was not, he was undaunted. He just thought it was cool. But, and I took a lesson from Leo. You know, here's the thing. In this world of secretive lice, just raise your head. This is, nobody's perfect, you know. We get lice, and it's fine, you know, and just raise your head up. And so I totally learned a lesson from Leo, you know, as I was annihilating these communities of lice on all of our heads, that, yes, it's something to respect, but we don't have to have them living on our heads.
So what was your favorite one, your favorite science experiment?
Oh, my gosh, I have so many. I like making your own petri dish and collecting bacteria. That's always fun because it's really kind of cool to see what's going on, and you don't think it's going on. There was a story in here where Leo had cut his hand open and needed to have stitches, and he was beside himself. I think it was the idea of stitches that bothered him more than anything else. He wasn't going to let it happen, and he was throwing a fit. We had five people holding him down, and many of them had earplugs, and he was beside himself, and I thought, okay. So I had made this little, with the tongue depressors, those little popsicle stick tongue depressors.
Yeah.
I had taped one together and put pennies underneath each side. It looked like a little dragonfly, and we were I was playing with the idea of center of balance, center of gravity, and I had him look away and try to balance this thing. And I thought, there's a metaphor right there. It's all about finding the balance of things, you know. And if you can focus on balancing, then you kind of focus away from the things that can be troubling to you. And so as he was focusing on this dragonfly balancing on the end of his finger, the doctor was able to stitch up his hand.
Cool.
And
okay.
That kind of was wonderful. And that was fun to play with them afterwards, too.
Well, that's great. All right. Lynn Brunell, the author of Mama Gone Geek, calling on my inner science nerd to help navigate the ups and downs of parenthood. Lynn, got a website?
I do. It's lynnbrunell.com.
And B-R-U-N-E-L-L-E.
That's
all right,
it.
Lynn, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.